Hey, this is Doc Mike. Welcome to the live show here on Real Liberty Media and also live over on Rumble. Come join us over there if you'd like to see the video of whatever I have up, which I have nothing up yet. It will be in just a sec. Oh my gosh, I have a loaded show for you again today. Let's get these guys up. I think they work pretty good. Yeah, the Eagles, we like that. Eagles in the background. Here comes some video. Hopefully it all works just right. You know, this is the second live show on Rumble, so I'm kind of trying things out, man. Last week we had some kind of frame drops and audio stuff and who knows what. But, you know, if you don't do a trial run between shows, well, this is what you get. So, I'm going to put my notes up here where I can see them. Rumble's not rumbling yet. I know there's some kind of a... No, it just says streaming. And I have actually really good stuff. Yeah, good. Yeah. Eagle is up, or maybe at least the eagle nest. Yeah, good. All right, well, let's get to it, because, I mean, I have a bunch of content tonight loaded. Actually, I only have four stories, four news-type articles that I think are pretty handy for the homestead, at least. I found them interesting. I hope you do, too. Anyway, this is Right on the Left Coast. It's a podcast about the Ravenwood Homestead we have here in Sheridan, Oregon. We have so if you were looking at Rumble before the show, hopefully it was playing like, I don't know, 20-second video. We found a hen down in the barn with four chicks, and she has six more eggs, maybe seven. You can't really see it clearly on the video because some of the eggs, some of the eggs didn't hatch yet, but still, she already hatched four of them and there's six more. So she's been sitting there for 28 days, and it's really kind of crazy because, you know, coons or possums or whatever could get right in there and get her, but they haven't yet. So we're going to kind of see what happens the next couple of days, whether we move the chicks into an incubator or just let life take its course. I don't know. But that was kind of a crazy and interesting find. Anyway, this is the fastest hour on Real Liberty Media, and I don't turn left. I'm just a guy shining some light on the darkness, trying to get some real truth out, besides all the crap you hear on mainstream media. Hey, if you're on a social media site, could you please post that we're live on Rumble and on Real Liberty Media, and we'll get people to come and, you know, check us out. Oh, the camera on the Eagle just went from daylight to night vision. That was kind of creepy. And cool. Oh no, now it goes back. Oh, so it's probably just that time wherever that nest is. I don't know where it is. Remember, tomorrow's the day, man. Hal Anthony, Behind the Woodshed, 2 solid hours of information. That guy doesn't take a break for 2 hours straight. Like, no breaks, none whatsoever. Just solid information and always really helpful. Interesting. The guy's got a great mind, a good thinker, really puts some stuff together. The live light is not on either. What live light? Is there a live light? Where's a live light? You know, we're working things out here. So let's just continue. Oh, you mean like on Rumble? Here, let's see if we can screw that up. Let's view live stream. I hit the play button. Oh, there I am. Okay, I got to get off there. Okay, I hit the live button, so you probably heard me, because it's delayed, like, I don't know how many minutes or seconds or whatever, but it takes a while to get from here to there. And I just viewed it here, so I'll show you. I'm gonna do it again. So I'm gonna hit the live button, and I'm gonna be quiet. Maybe I can mute this. Yeah, I'll mute it. Oh, there it is. Live. Okay, maybe I have something different because. Oh, and it is dropping some frames. So new settings may not be the greatest. It's okay. Let's go back to the Eagle. You know, we're doing this on a shoestring budget, for crying out loud. I'm kidding. But, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. Always. I'll figure it out, though. I figured this out. You know, I still go back to the very beginning of this podcast. And I've always, since 1999, I've been a Linux guy. But I had Windows at the time because I kind of, you know, from working in different, well, 100 miles away, and having, you know, corporate computers instead of my own personal computers, I had Windows, and I made the switch, went back to Windows. I learned how to do the show live, I learned how to podcast, I learned how to do audio and video and all this stuff, and I'm still learning, which is awesome. It's really actually pretty awesome. So, if the live video sucks, don't worry about it. Turn it off, listen on Real Liberty Media, or just listen, although it probably sucks listening to. Oh yeah, now I'm getting some frame drops. That's okay. Okay. Red when live. Hey, let's do this. I'm gonna go to a static picture, because maybe there's just too much video trying to run here at the homestead. Okay. Now I'm going to be completely honest. I try always to be completely honest. And I really debated on whether to share this information with everybody, because a number of reasons. One is you're going to have people who, you know, just are going to, I don't know, call you names and call you an idiot. And maybe even animal rights activists would come after me for being a dumbass, which I would blame them. Stuff on the homestead happens. And I kind of hinted at this last week with the guineas. And remember, I was doing like 20-minute rounds on the guinea fowl. Well, I'm just going to tell you the truth here. Out of 14 guineas, one survived. And yeah, that is disastrous. Now, I think I know what happened. And that is the first day they arrived. Like, I had their area set up, and I had it warm, but it wasn't hot. And guineas need to be, and I think a lot of chicks need to be like 95 degrees when they're first born. I had no idea. 95 degrees is pretty damn hot, you can imagine. And just thinking about, you know, burning stuff down, like, you know, burning the house down or catching melting plastic or setting the bedding on fire, stuff like that. You kind of worry about getting stuff that hot. But, man, just slowly, like every couple hours, and it would seem like all the chicks were fine. They had food, they had water, they had heat. But the first night, man, the first day I got them, I had it probably at 80 degrees or maybe 70 something degrees. Okay. I think it was just too much. I think it just crippled them so badly being cold those first couple hours. Then no matter what I did, I couldn't keep them from dying. Like we were literally trying to feed them some chick starter liquid. It has vitamins and I don't know. It's a balanced electrolytes and stuff, so that you know you can. So it's to get them started, to give them a good start. But anyway, oh, there we go. Oh, good. But anyway, yeah. So 13 of them died, man, and that's horrible. I know it's horrible, and yeah, I feel bad that I wasn't better prepared, or I didn't maybe think about it a little better. You know what's kind of funny is, like finding this hen down in the barn with four chicks, and they're perfectly fine, and she's got six more eggs. And I'm thinking, you know, we go through all this trouble to try and like hatch eggs and keep the chicks alive and stuff, and it's just so natural. But it's not like hens sit on their eggs all the time. Well, number one, we take them every day. So unless they go lay somewhere else where we're not taking their eggs, yeah, they're not going to get broody. Broody means sit on the eggs and hatch them. They're not going to get broody because we took the egg, so there's nothing to sit on. So they would like go back to the nest box and be like, "Oh, where's my egg?" You know, because they got to get down and eat at some time and drink and, you know, stretch their legs. But anyway, so yeah, horrible luck on the guineas. I'm watching the little numbers here, kind of tells me what's going on. And I, you know, I hope it doesn't bother you, but I'm kind of watching dropped frames, 19%. That's a lot. Yeah, maybe I just can't do live video because I'm not going to get faster internet. And you know, putting the video recording up later is fine, I think. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, so you know, the truth is, yeah, you know, operator error. I killed most of the yeah, moody does rhyme with broody, and that's kind of true too. They get kind of moody when they're broody. Yeah, so I killed 13 out of the 14 guineas. And I ordered some more, and I have the new incubator set up. And let me tell you something, man. This new incubator is pretty damned amazing because I set it at 95 degrees and set it up, and I've been letting it run for a couple days. And it's just cruising along, like 95 degrees. I forget what percent humidity they're supposed to be at. It's for hatching eggs, but you can use it for brooding also. You can put a brooding mat down in it. And yeah, it's working great. It was kind of expensive, and it does like 48 eggs or something like that, 56, I don't know. It does a bunch. And we'll never hatch that many, but you know, the idea was to hatch out some eggs, grow some chickens for meat, so that's what we'll do. And if I need to use this for the new batch of guineas that are on the way next week, I will not hesitate to put them right in there and keep them toasty warm while they're getting used to life. And hopefully, I don't have that disaster again, because, God dang, man, you just feel so bad for these animals. Like, what the hell did I do wrong? And you know, after the first day, you're kind of like, okay, well, I'm doing everything I can to save them, but I think they got so cold. And by cold, I mean 75, 80 degrees. But Jesus, if they're supposed to be at 95 and you have them at 80, that's 15 degrees cooler than they're supposed to be. I just don't think you can keep them alive like that. So anyway, that's the bad news of the week. I think that's the worst news of the week. And hopefully things get better from here. I got to tell you this little story because this is a kind of a funny story. We have this Empress tree, and I might have mentioned this before on, you know, some previous podcast about just how crazy this tree has gone, but not so much the height or the breadth of this tree, but the root system, man. The root system, it has, the roots were so big, the roots were almost as big as the damn trunk of the tree. Now, the tree is still up outside there, right outside the man cave here. But we dug up some of the roots, cut them off, because they were destroying a brick walkway we had between the two houses. And we'd been thinking about rerouting this walkway before and letting those roots grow. But it's just getting ridiculous. It was like a volcano was starting to come up through the soil there. And it had to be taken care of. So it's taken care of now. But we have this huge kind of construction site just outside the man cave where we dug up the roots, we cut the roots off. Now we gotta lay down some, well, we're gonna put down some sandy loam and reroute the bricks, and we'll have a nice walkway, and we won't have this one muddy area that we have now that's right outside of the door of the man cave and the little sitting area that we have out here that we sit outside when it's nice, and even when it's not nice, we just bundle up and sit out there and enjoy a fire on a patio or watch some ball games out there or whatever. But that freaking Empress tree is so funny. I remember when my wife planted it, which was, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, something like that. And I said, "What is that?" It was this little tiny twig of a tree. And she goes, "Oh, it's an Empress tree. They're really beautiful. You know, they have these big giant leaves and these big flowers." And she says, "They're really beautiful." And I go, "Well, how big is it going to get?" And she told me like 10, 12 feet, which it's about that, 10 or 12 feet. But we never anticipated the roots exploding like they did and completely changing the geography of the lawn. And that's the little patch of lawn that we really that little patch of lawn is one of the patches that we actually keep green and fertilized for looks. Like, I always wanted just one patch of grass in a yard that was just like beautiful, and we Rochelle has accomplished that. Vinny's having trouble with Twitter. Oh, well. We're all having problems today, Vinny. Hey, by the way, I'm just going to bring you up to date on a couple things. One is I had a lung x-ray about 2 weeks ago. It's perfectly fine, which I don't believe at all. And I had a shoulder MRI yesterday. And it looks like there may be a tear, but it's not conclusive. So I'll see what the doc says this week when he, you know, calls me and has me come in for a review. But basically, you know, things are good. You know, things are good. You never know. The ferments are going good. Oh, I played Little Green Tractor at the very beginning of the show because guess what? Today was the first day I had to mow. So out mowing the lawn, the big orchard, which, you know, is kind of fun because, well, number one, I'm on the tractor. And number two, I get to look at, you know, and I've said before, when I get out there on the tractor to mow the orchard, I kind of check everything out, like the orchard, the trees, see if they're budding, see if any of them died, see if, you know, we have to sturdy any of them up from the winds and the rain and the snow of winter and spring. And the apple tree actually looks like it has buds this year. So we'll see what happens, because remember last year it budded out and then we got snow on it and then rain and wind and all the blossoms never got pollinated. The bees weren't even out because it stayed cold for so long. But this is like the second March in, I don't know how many years, 5 years, that was coldest March on record here in Oregon. So I don't know. We'll see. But it was nice to look at all the trees. Like, I see them every day anyway, but when you're on a tractor, you have to go around each tree and you kind of get a chance to really kind of check them out and like, oh, okay, you know, this is what we have here. Everything looks good so far. So I think that's awesome. The garden just getting cranked up. There's a lot of stuff going on in the greenhouse. I'll have to go out and get some more video of the hydroponic system. It's kind of funny. I don't know, a week or so ago, I made some new ferments. I got to keep that thing going because, man, I'm telling you, I'm hooked. I'm hooked on the carrots and jalapeno and onion. This time I put a little cilantro in there with some garlic cloves and black pepper. I think it'll be perfect. But I can't run out. And, you know, I take them to work to get let people try them. And of course, everybody here likes to eat them. And so they go fast. So it's kind of one of those things, man. I'm going to have to start making bigger containers or just more containers. Oh yeah, and I put some cilantro in this one. But here's what I was going to tell you. This is kind of funny. So we had cilantro out on the, well, we have a kind of a vegetable area outside because it's not cold enough to freeze them, and it's not warm enough that, I mean, it's almost like a refrigerator outside anyway. Now that's not going to last much longer. But they stay fresh out there, so we just leave them outside. Well, I went out to get some cilantro, and it had been kind of wrapped up in plastic and maybe sat too long, and it had some mold growing on it. I was like, oh, I'm not going to use this stuff. And then Rochelle tells me, you know, we have cilantro growing in the hydroponic out there in the greenhouse. You can just go clip some off. I was like, holy hell, this is awesome. Like, now I know I have an endless supply of cilantro right out in the greenhouse. And that was the purpose of that hydroponic unit, was to give us some greens that we can just constantly harvest. And, you know, that's what it's for. So I'm really excited about that because, like I said, I'm going to keep these ferments going. And I think I'm going to change something around on my desktop. You guys don't mind, do you? Of course you don't. But of course, let's see if I can shut something off while I'm doing this. One thing, I'm going to shut that off. I'm going to move this over here. And what happened here? Oh, there we go. Oh, okay. I see how you are. Where to now? And chicks, of course, the chicks. So we have the natural born chicks in the barn. We added a bunch of chicks this year and a turkey and I don't know, a duck or two, maybe four. And then we're getting the new shipment of guineas this week. We'll see what happens there. But yeah, everything now is going fine. And we did have one guinea fowl survive. So we'll see what happens. But we're ready for this next batch. I am 100% ready for this next batch of guinea fowl, and hope to God we have better luck. At least I won't start them off freezing cold. Oh, good. I'm glad the lighting's good. Okay, well, let's look at some stories here. I got to get these lined up too. 18,000 cows killed. Oh, go away. Would you really? No, I'm not disabling my ad blocker. Can you just go away? Oh my God, really? Okay, well, we don't care, right? I don't. I'm going to close it. There you go. Go away. So 18,000 cows were killed in an explosion. In Texas, no, where was it? This damn picture. Okay, 18. There you go. Go away. 18,000 cows killed in explosion fire at Texas dairy farm. Maybe the largest cattle killing ever. Really, maybe. It may be the largest cattle killing ever. Well, I would hope to shout. But number one, how in the hell do you kill 18,000 cows? I mean, I do know how you kill 18,000 cows. And the way you do that is by having them concentrated in such a small area that they can't move and they can't get away and they can't go anywhere or do anything. And I think that's exactly what happened. These concentrated feedlots, in this case, hey, should we look? No, we shouldn't. I shouldn't get distracted. Yeah, the cow, I guess some explosion happened, and who knows? They say there a malfunction in a piece of farm equipment may have caused the explosion that led to the fire, and the fire spread from, from like corral to corral or confined area to confined area. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but what the hell is burning, number one, and burning enough to actually kill 18,000 cows? As morbid as it may sound, I almost want to see video of how in the hell that happened because it's so hard to believe. They say that that's enough cows to cover 26 football fields. Can you even imagine? 18,000 cows gone. Another accident on a big dairy farm. Oh my God, man. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel pretty bad about the 13 guinea fowl that didn't make it because of, operator error on my part. But Jesus, 18,000 dairy cows? That's a lot of milk and butter and sour cream. Yeah, and I'd say beef, but I don't think they, well, actually, I was going to say, I don't think they eat the dairy cows once they're done, because they're probably pretty used up. I mean, a long time ago, way back in the Blog Talk Radio days, I did a whole story on how dairy cattle are abused as hell. And I'm not saying like some animal rights activist. I'm not saying that they're abused, like they're not beaten or anything like that. But Jesus, there's sometimes there's another red flag full of frame drops. But sometimes, I mean, these dairy cattle are, they're in a concentrated area. They used to be, back in the day, they would jack them up with hormones so they produced milk and produced more milk, and then they just, feed them whatever, and the feed isn't exactly, dietitian recommended feed. It's whatever the crap you can get in that cow to keep them producing milk for a year or two. And that's the other thing. I remember, so one of my buddies was a dairy farmer, dairy cow farmer. He wasn't, he became my friend, but he was actually my hunting buddy's friend. So my hunting buddy was 20 years older than me, and Henry, the dairy farmer, was 10 years older than him. And my hunting buddy was a butcher, and Henry was a dairy cattle farmer. And Henry would tell me, he said, yeah, those cows only you live like 2 to 4 years. And Temple Grandin, I have not. Anyway, so Henry would tell me that these dairy cows would only live for like 2 to 4 years, which that doesn't make sense because they got to be old enough to have a calf, and then, well, I think they got to have calves to produce milk. But who knows? Maybe they just jack them up with hormones and have them produce milk, or fake a pregnancy, or God, I don't know what. The things that go on with food these days is why you should really take a look at trying to produce some food of your own that you know is safe and that you can protect it and keep it safe. But anyway, So those dairy cattle didn't live very long a few years ago, and they would just milk the hell out of them and get as much, you know, the idea was to produce as much milk as possible from each cow. So, you know, it just burn them up really fast. Matter of fact, I'll tell you a crazy story. One of the first places I lived when I came back to Oregon in 1997 was literally right across the street from a dairy farm. And one day, like I'd only lived there a few months, I only lived in this house for about a year, I think. And so I was always watching this dairy farm just because I was interested, like what the hell goes on in the dairy farm. Well, one day, like the dairy cows were always inside. They were inside, like, I don't know, I think they didn't ever move. I think they just stayed in a stall. And they just fed them and milked them and whatever, took care of them in those stalls all day. Because one day, all of a sudden, all the dairy cows are out wandering around in the fields. And I'm like, oh, man, they have a ton of cows. Because before, you had no idea how many cows they had because they're in buildings. And then all of a sudden, this one day in the spring, they had all these cows out in the field. Well, guess what? Like 2-3 days later, there's like dead cows all over the place. Not all of them, but 4 or 5 dead cows. Like, why did they die? I have no idea. But that was an eye-opener, because you think, oh, the cows are out, they're enjoying the grass and having a good time. Oh, no, yeah, and then they're dropping like flies. Deader than hell right there in the field. Oh, my gosh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, one thing I wanted to mention is, remember what I said about all these accidents and fires and, you know, food processing plants and food storage plants and, you know, bird flu, you know, coming in and destroying millions of birds, chickens and turkeys and God knows, California condors and now the cattle. And I said before, man, with all these devices that are on the internet, and every single one of them, if they're on the internet, they can be hacked. And if they're not on the internet, they have Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, you could get close enough to hack them. I'm not saying there's no evidence, there's some going to be an investigation with this dairy farm, but I truly believe that somebody is doing this stuff on purpose, and that would be a perfect way to do something and make it look like an accident. And no, FBI and CIA, I have no idea how to do that. I don't really. You'll just have to take my word for it. Okay. God, I think I had another story. Oh, yeah, this story is kind of along those lines. Let's have a look at this. Maybe. Yes. All right. So this is kind of crazy. So it says the E. coli super pathogens you should know about. Now, the reason I'm bringing this story up here, I got to fix my notes because, you know, I messed them up with that. The reason I'm bringing this up is because even last week I was talking about how your vegetables can become tainted if you buy them in the store, you know, and how come we hear about, you know, salmonella and E. coli in like celery and lettuce and vegetables, you know, in the store. It's, I know. I'm sorry. It's probably true. I mean, I probably have some information about doing those kind of things, but I wouldn't dare. So let me get to this. I got to get down to in my notes because this is way down here. Okay, so many times on the Homestead Show, I've talked about E. coli showing up in our vegetables, and you likely have heard why. I mean, there aren't too many ways for a gut bacterium to get on your vegetables, right? Now we have this to be wary of, and another good reason to be more intimately involved with where your food comes from and who is handling it. And the reason I said intimately involved is because, you know, if you can use some local sources, like, I don't know, I know that, you know, we buy stuff from the supermarket, from the produce section, but I'd really like to get away from that. And, you know, it's getting to be that time of year where we're going to have more vegetables readily available at roadside stands and at, you know, farmers markets. We have two markets between here and McMinnville. McMinnville's 15 miles away. And we have Farmer John's and Bernard's Farm. Both of them sell stuff right out of their field. So if you had a problem with any of their stuff, like you could go right to them, you know, and say, hey, I got E. coli from your celery. It will never happen here. It just mark my words, it will not happen at one of those two places. But, you know, you go in a supermarket, you don't know where the hell these vegetables are from. I mean, yeah, they put stickers on them if you believe that sticker to be true. Because so many times, that's a long story, but vegetables will come across the border, but then because they're in California, they get, you know, a California sticker or who knows, whatever other state. I'm not going to blame California. But, yeah. So anyway, you know, we hear about E. coli breakouts all the time. So I'm going to kind of do a basic review here. Foodborne illnesses, also known as food poisoning, are a serious public health issue. Each year, they make 48 million people get sick, hospitalize 128,000, and cause the death of 3,000. Pathogenic E. coli is one of the most common known foodborne pathogens. However, the severity of various E. coli strains varies tremendously, and the public should be cautious about one particularly dangerous type of E. coli. So the normal illness, E. coli, the E. coli we infamously know from the news, belong to the group of enteropathogenic E. coli, EPEC, and are pathogens responsible for food poisoning. Foodborne illnesses also include salmonella and norovirus. And norovirus, I mean, come on. You know where norovirus comes from. Like one place. And it's not your nose, and it's not your mouth, and it's not your eyes, and it's, I was going to say not your fingers, but it could be, I suppose. Anyway, those are responsible for the most recent cruise ship outbreaks. Typically, an E. coli infection occurs when a person comes into contact with contaminated food, animals, or water. It usually only causes mild abdominal pain or brief diarrhea. Other symptoms include stomach cramps, nausea, vomiting, and fever. Yeah. Well, because it's a bacteria, yeah, it could cause a fever and infection, of course. The normal treatment for normal E. coli, the typical treatment, usually involves rest, hydration, and nutritional support. Like, don't eat whatever it is that, you know, caused it. The disease is usually self-limiting as the body can normally clear it. The use of antibiotics is common in treating E. coli, yet antibiotic resistance is also a problem worldwide. However, severe forms of E. coli are the Shiga toxin-producing variants of the bacteria that can have dire consequences. Now here comes the super E. coli. Let me get a drink. Oh, that's so refreshing. The variants of E. coli that produce Shiga toxins are called Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, or STEC. They have gained a lot of attention in the past few decades as they are known for causing severe disease. The toxins are named after Kiyoshi Shiga, who first described the bacterial origin of dysentery caused by Shigella dysenteria. Shiga toxins are also associated with hemolytic uremia syndrome. Like, hemolytic means like blood cells, uremic is something to do with your kidneys, urethra, something. In particular, the STEC, STEC-015787, something else, the two most notorious STEC strains. One can say these STEC groups are something like super soldiers in the E. coli army. Here's the illness. The Shiga toxin does most of its work in small blood vessels, as it is rather ineffective in large vessels such as major veins and arteries. This is how the toxin can specialize against the digestive tract, kidney, and lungs. For example, the Shiga toxins are good at destroying clusters of nerve endings, that's awesome, or blood vessels in the kidneys, which can lead to kidney failure and even HUS, whatever that is. It can severely damage the lungs as well, so food poisoning associated with Shiga toxins is often also associated with lung and nervous system damage. Check this out, like an E. coli basically destroying your entire body. About 20% of patients with STEC-HUS experience symptoms outside the liver that might impact the cardiovascular system, pancreas, intestines, skin, and even fingers and toes. However, there has been much debate about treating STEC infections with antibiotics. No data convincingly demonstrate that antibiotics are better than no antibiotic treatment at all, and many studies suggest antibiotics increase the risk of developing HUS. Treatment. Currently, STEC-HUS treatment relies heavily on supportive care, which includes fluid resuscitation, the correction of electrolyte abnormalities, and the control of hypertension. Blood or platelet transfusions and liver replacement therapy, good Lord, are often required. Other treatments include plasma exchange and, an anti-clotting drug, Eculizumab, anti-clotting drug, dual anticoagulant therapy. We're all familiar with it. So that's kind of crazy, man. There's an E. coli out there that's horrendous. Like, literally can kill you. I mean, if you need a liver transplant, you're in big trouble. If your kidneys quit working, you're in big trouble. If your nerve endings to your lung, liver, pancreas, intestines. Baby cat's up here. Maybe she's going to join the show. Miss Pebbles. Anyway, so I wanted to bring that up because, man, I know some people don't have really any choice than to go and buy vegetables. Be careful. And of course, you have somebody like Bill Gates who's out there trying to, spray something on the vegetables, coat the vegetables with something that, will make them last longer. And God knows what's in the stuff he's going to be spraying on the vegetables. And of course, injecting cattle with mRNA vaccines. I mean, he's basically out of control now. So, back to what? Oh, you guys are going to love this story. Honestly, I've been waiting for this. I can't tell you how long I've been waiting for this, but let me just finish up on the E. coli thing. It's bad enough just to get E. coli, but if you get this Shiga E. coli, I mean, it can be absolutely disastrous. So be careful. If you can, raise some of your own food, raise some of your own food. If you can't, man, support those local farmers. Go look at their farms. Like, you can literally go sit and watch them farm. See where their outhouses are. See if they have clean facilities for people who are harvesting Do they harvest by hand? Do they harvest by machine? Do those things look clean? I don't mean perfectly spotless. Well, yeah, hands. But the machines, of course, if you drive them one path down the whatever row of veggies, are going to be dirty. But I mean, generally, are they clean? You know, are the people, do they seem like they're going to be, you know, stand behind their vegetables if something happens? And I mean, the thing is, they're local. So they don't want to make the local population sick, right? It doesn't make sense, because that would be the end of your reputation as a local farmer. But anyway, support these local farmers. You know, if they have community-supported agriculture, which usually requires you to pay a monthly fee or to pay a fee for 6 months or to pay microgreens, absolutely, man. You can grow a lot of microgreens and feed yourself for a long time, and you're in charge of whether that's going to be healthy or not, whether it's going to get exposed to E. coli or not. Yeah, so support the local farmers, community-supported agriculture, grow some microgreens, grow some sprouts, grow some potatoes, you know, grow some stuff yourself. If you have very limited space, concentrate that growing in the microgreens, a perfect way to do it. I still have to do that, just to experience it myself. But let's move on to this story, because, man, I've been waiting on this story. I'm not kidding. I've been waiting for this story to actually be released to the public, because I, as many of you know, I'm a dentist, and I do not and have never believed in fluoride, especially fluoride in the water system. I mean, why can't we just put birth control in the water system? Except now our populations are in danger of disappearing because we haven't been reproducing enough, and we're not going to. So, you know, the end of mankind will come before global warming ever kicks in. But, you know, oh well. But yeah, here's the deal. Bad news for the dental community. The National Toxicology Program, NTP, on Wednesday released a draft report linking prenatal and childhood fluoride exposure to reduced IQ in children after public health officials tried for almost a year to block its publication. I know. I hope you are. I need to order the stuff and grow microgreens. Thank you. I'm going to be on it. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention initially blocked the NTP from releasing the report, according to emails obtained via a Freedom of Information Act. Now listen. So the Department of Health and Human Services and a Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which have been around for decades, maybe a century, and they've been promoting and forcing the use of fluoride, you know, into mothers, prenatal mothers, you know, mothers who are pregnant and haven't delivered yet, and infants and children. And listen, this is why I've never been a fan of fluoride. It wasn't because I knew it was a poison. It wasn't because I knew it was toxic. It wasn't because I knew it caused lower IQs. It's because the frickin' bond of fluoride to tooth structure is so damn weak that it doesn't last long. Yes, if you take it prenatally and get it into that fetus while it's developing, because the tooth buds start developing way before the baby is born, and then when they're infants and children under 5 years old, you give them fluoride, and yes, it gets built into the tooth structure, the crystalline structure of enamel. But the problem is the bond is so weak between fluoride and hydroxyapatite crystals that it's not permanent. And topically, like when you put fluoride in, you know, when you would go to the dentist and he put that tray in your mouth for like 30 seconds or 2 minutes or whatever it is, And that should tell you something. I don't even know how long those trays go in for because I never used them. Like, I would not use fluoride on any of my patients, not adults, not children, not infants, not prenatal, nothing. Nope. Didn't do it because they tell you right in dental school, okay, look, fluoride has a very weak bond to enamel, but you know, it's the best thing we got. This poison, it's the best thing we got to prevent tooth decay. Now, if it had worked, I wouldn't be working today. I'd be, you know, this would be me. Welcome to Walmart. Do you need a cart? But no, I'm still, you know, chest deep in dental decay, in children, in young adults, in seniors, and of course we have, I don't know what percent of the population in full dentures now, because, you know, decay and periodontal disease and whatever else has led to tooth loss. See, if fluoride was awesome, well, everybody be walking around with beautiful white teeth and no decay, right? But that's not the way it is. So the Health and Human Services and the Center for Disease Control, you know what, I got to tell you something else. On the Indian reservations, because I was a dentist at Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation, Lame Deer, Montana, for 3 years, and you know, they absolutely 100%, they were like hair on fire crazy about putting fluoride in the water, getting fluoride in the mothers, getting fluoride in the kids, getting fluoride in everybody and on everybody, you know, because we got to prevent this tooth decay. You know, the natives on that reservation had far bigger problems than tooth decay. 95% of the population over 10 years old or 5 years old, I can't remember, 95% drank and drank heavily, were alcoholics. So it wouldn't really matter how much fluoride you've got into their system. Their abuse of alcohol was basically going to lead to them losing their teeth, because anytime you abuse a substance, you don't take care of your teeth. Like, okay, I'm going to shoot up some heroin and then I'm going to drink this 40-ounce bottle of sugar water, Coke, Pepsi, whatever, and then I'm going to eat a bag of Doritos and a bag of double-stuffed Oreos, and I'm going to pass out. So your teeth are just going to rot away anyway, because the last thing you're thinking about is carrying a toothbrush and toothpaste around with you. And I mean, that's for any drug, legal or illegal, any abuse whatsoever, chemical abuse whatsoever, is going to aid in, you know, you losing your teeth, unless you're just crazy about brushing your teeth, which I've never seen that happen. Anyway, according to its website, the NTP removed the hazardous classification of fluoride in response to comments in the peer review process. Yet the report states our meta-analysis confirms results of previous meta-analysis and extends them by including newer, more precise studies with individual level exposure measures. The data support a consistent inverse association between fluoride exposure and children's IQ. Isn't that awesome? Like, not only have we made the public school system, the teachers in the public school system, like basically make public school students stupid, but we've literally decreased their IQ by poisoning them with fluoride, which is a toxin. Yeah, exactly. Doctors gave mothers who lived on wells drops back in the day. Yeah, because, you know, well, you can't be living on that fantastic well water that's got no poisons in it. Here, we'll supplement it with some poison of our own. The results were robust to stratifications by risk of bias, gender, age group, outcome assessment, study location, exposure timing, exposure type, including both drinking water and urinary fluoride. These findings fly in the face of the empty, unscientific claims U.S. health officials have propagated for years, namely that water fluoridation is safe and beneficial. Said, guess who? My new favorite hero, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Children's Health Defense Chairman and Chief Litigation Counsel. It's past time to eliminate this neurotoxin from our water supply. Man, and I got to tell you, this is one of those things that I've looked back in my life and said, man, I am so glad I made that decision when I did. Oh my God, we have 4 minutes, 3.5 minutes, okay. Well, I had this one really long article about natural alternatives to ibuprofen, but we're going to skip to the last article here, which is really kind of cool. This is something I had no idea, and now I have to try this too. So while I'm learning to do microgreens, I am going to also look into this. It says another natural remedy, and this is called dragon's blood, one of the most potent sources of antioxidants on the planet. And I just want to read you some notes about this. I'll try and make this quick. The ancient remedy has been used for centuries, and scientists are discovering the mechanisms behind its long-recognized effects. Out of 3,100 foods, beverages, spices, herbs, and supplements used worldwide, dragon's blood is the highest known antioxidant tested according to a study. It's the highest known antioxidant tested, published in the Nutrition Journal. The dark red tree resin has been used for medicine for more than 1,000 years by many ancient civilizations, including the Greeks, Romans, and has been used in many traditional medicine systems worldwide, including traditional Chinese medicine, Arabic medicine, Thai medicine, and African medicine. Some of its uses and applications include healing wounds, hemostasis, killing pain, and curing various conditions such as diarrhea, dysentery, and ulcers. In addition to medicinal applications, dragon's blood has also been used as a coloring material, varnish, incense, and for ceremonial purposes. Here's the things that have all been linked to this dragon's blood resin. It's antibacterial, antifungal, heals worms, it probably does, heals wounds. It's effective against H. pylori, it's effective in ulcer treatment, and it's an anti-aging agent, well, at least some people claim. Dragon's blood comes in powder or capsule supplements, as well as alcohol extracts, tinctures, and topical ointments. Always make sure to source your products from reputable and trustworthy companies, as the supplement industry isn't tightly regulated. So you got to kind of look around, ask people, you know, where the best stuff is. I don't know. They probably have somewhere somebody kind of rates these things and will be able to tell. In recent interview, Matt Royce, founder of Cultivate Elevate, said that when it comes to purchasing dragon's blood products, you want to make sure it is not altered with any synthetic fillers, gums, or preservatives. Always make sure your dragon's blood is sustainably sourced and heavy metal tested. So we got about 30 seconds. That was awesome. I don't know how. It still says we had 20% frame drops. Man, that's a ton. I don't know. Might not do lives again. We'll see. Hey, but anyway, thank you for joining me. Remember, you can catch the Homestead Show here, which is right on the Left Coast Radio. We do this every Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern. I do more of a current event kind of show on Wednesday called the Discerning Observer podcast on Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And I look forward to seeing you guys then. Catch Hal Anthony tomorrow behind the woodshed at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 hours nonstop. Thanks again for joining me, y'all.